I'm Derek Russell.
And I'm Brad Locke, and this is The Memo,
a gathering of all things Northeast Mississippi, brought to you by The Daily Journal and DJournal.com.
It's Thursday morning, and this is The Memo. Welcome, and thanks for listening. I'm Emma Kent, a new host here, and Chris Kiefer is here with me today, filling in for Derek Russell, who is out sick. So,
good morning.
Morning. So, Chris, I'm sure you've heard we had a famous author in town yesterday.
Yeah, and you went.
Yeah, Richard Grant, who wrote Dispatches from Pluto, which is a book about his sort of journey.
He's from New York, right?
He's from London.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's British, which makes it even more interesting.
Did he have a thick accent?
Yeah, it was a British accent. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, crazy. I wonder if maybe being here has changed his accent a little bit.
Aside, have people told you that about your accent? Like, I'll get from growing up in New Orleans,
yeah,
living here, New York for a year. Just like, I think everything, it just like all mixes together. And wherever mm-hmm. I am, people just tell me I'm not from around here. But
even here?
Yeah, definitely
yeah.
here. Yeah,
oh,
I definitely get here. But then they also say that I don't have a New Orleans accent.
And yeah.
I think some of that is because people don't know what a New Orleans accent is, and they think it's like a heavy Cajun accent, which is false. But anyway,
now I'm
interesting.
I don't know. People don't say that to me, but since I've moved here, I've adopted a thicker Southern accent than before. But when I was growing
it's not
up,
thick, but
it's like it's more than it was. When I was growing up, I didn't have an accent because we lived in. We lived in Georgia, in Atlanta, which isn't,
it's
not the most Southern place. It's still kind of.
But I think being a big city, you just get a mix. That's what mine is in New Orleans. When I go back and hear home videos, or I remember like when I was a freshman at Ole Miss, Parrish Alford. Now, you still hear at the Daily Journal, but I covered sports. And I remember when I'd cover things with him, he'd make fun of. He's a Louisiana guy too, but I used to say Carrie and like really like drag it out. And it's kind of like a Brooklyn accent.
Yeah. Yeah.
The New Orleans accent if you. Are doing it proper.
I wonder what people in Brooklyn think about that.
Yeah.
They probably think it's cool.
Think it's
New
cool.
Orleans is pretty hip.
Yeah, it's a good place.
They're into that.
Yeah. Brethren. Brooklyn's hip too, so they kind of.
Same thing.
Yeah.
Same place,
yeah,
basically.
Exactly.
We moved. Let's see. We moved to New Jersey when I was younger. We only lived there for about a year, but none of my teachers up there. Like, they never were like, oh, you're from the South. Like, we can tell, you know, but I guess I just didn't have an accent. I was only like 10,
yeah.
But my mom has a really thick accent and all of her friends that she made up there they just loved it when she would talk or when she would say y'all or whatever,
it
was like a novelty thing. And for us, it was the opposite. We thought their accents were really crazy.
Right.
You know, that New Jersey, New York accent. But yeah, anyway. All that to say,
yeah. Richard Grant.
Richard Grant. He didn't. He had a British accent. I mean, he's definitely British.
Uh-huh.
But
subdued.
Yeah, but it was like a. Yeah, subdued is a good word.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it wasn't overwhelming.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's a cool accent, though. I mean, the British accent is a cool accent.
It's really cool. It's probably the best accent that there is. Sorry, other accents, but
hey, deal with it.
I'm picking British is number one. So.
Yeah, it's a good one.
But yeah. He gave a good talk. It was really interesting just to hear from someone who's from such a different place, and he moved to the Delta.
Mm-hmm. So backing up, that's what the book is about, right? It's about his experience.
Yeah.
The stories I read, what he bought a plantation in.
He bought a house.
I've never even heard of Pluto, Mississippi before.
It's like really tiny. I think it's really close to Yazoo City.
Okay.
He... like was living in New York and was writing freelance and had written some books or something. And he had been to Oxford a lot.
Okay, of course.
Right. Because of the writing community there. And then I guess he like had a friend that he met in Oxford who like was from the Delta. And so he went down there and her father's house was for sale. And it's like this big, really old, you know, one of those just really big, beautiful homes.
Bellum, maybe.
Yeah. He said it was really
roughly,
old.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure, but But yeah, one of those. Mm-hmm. And he like just bought it and moved down there and was like, we're just going to move here, me and him and his girlfriend. And so
was he intending to write a book at the time? Was this kind of like did he think it'd be a book project or did that come up later? Did he say?
I think at first he just like was like, we should just do this. And then I'm sure that in the back of his mind, probably
yeah.
it was like,
if you're an author,
this could be a cool book. And then pretty soon after he said he started writing about it and, you know, putting the book together. So it's a really good book.
Dispatches from Pluto, mm-hmm. correct?
Yeah. It's really interesting. He does a really good job of just sort of like capturing that Mississippi thing. That's like, you know, it's like there's some really weird stuff and there's some kind of tough things about the state and its history and its culture. But then there's also like these really sort of captivating things about it. And you kind of almost can't describe why you like it so much.
It's the nuance. And I feel that it gets lost in a lot of the national narrative and dialogue of Mississippi.
Right.
But there is so much nuance, so much gray. And so I'm guessing that's probably what
he cuts through the stereotype stuff and just sort of tells it like it is.
Depth.
But with that nuance, it's just a really good read.
Yeah.
So, and it was very interesting to hear him speak about it. He was it seemed like a very sincere, just a good guy. So, it was a good event. And I think, the audio from the event is streaming on the library's website.
Okay,
so
great.
If you missed it, you can check it out there.
Good.
And listen to his talk because, it was really good. So
it's the Lee County Library. So if you Google it, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know the exact URL, but
right.
Lee County Library. I know they were recording it for that. So.
Yeah, good deal. Good. Was it a good crowd?
Yeah, it was a big crowd.
Good.
Yeah, it was a lot of people, so that was good to see.
Including Baby Shepherd.
Yes, sweet, sweet Baby Shepherd.
It's J.B. Clark, former Daily Journal reporter, and April Clark, of course. But J.B. and April's baby, I think, was the star.
Star of the show.
Besides Richard Grant.
He got a lot of attention. Yeah. He's a cutie.
Yeah.
So, alrighty. Well, I guess we should do the show.
Yeah, we've got it. We got a little twist on our normal entertainment episode. Derek, of course, is at 6, so we won't have the scene section. And Jenna, we've got a brief food section because she had an interview this morning. So we've got food. We've got Scott's movie review, but we've also got a bonus news story for you. Kayla Bedillion is going to join us today and talk about the Alabama Senate race and possible implications for Mississippi's race in 2018. I guess. Let's
cool.
get to it.
Cool. Okay, and now Kayla Bedillion, our city government reporter, is joining us to talk about the Alabama Senate race earlier this week and how that might affect Roger Wicker in the 2018 Republican primary. So, Caleb, let's talk about Chris McDaniel.
That's right.
So, what's kind of the relationship between these two races? I mean, why or how is Tuesday's race, which was between Luther Strange and Roy Moore, and of course Roy Moore ended up winning. How is that going to affect, or how might it affect Wicker and McDaniel?
Right now, as I'm sure most of our listeners recall, Chris McDaniel, who is a state senator from Ellisville in Jones County, ran a primary challenge against Thad Cochran in 2014. And that race was, you know, widely seen as a Tea Party style candidate, insurgent conservative, as they're sometimes called, against, you know, a longtime incumbent, fairly associated with the kind of establishment, you know, more country club wing of the party. McDaniel just narrowly lost the race in a runoff and has been pretty, I'm going to say, bitter about it since then, because Cochran's victory was largely seen as being fueled by crossover Democrat votes. So Alabama special election, it was a Republican primary runoff on Tuesday. We saw similar dynamics, though some differences. We can get into those later. Luther Strange was appointed in February by Alabama's now former governor to fill the seat of former Senator Jeff Sessions, who's now the United States Attorney General.
For now.
For now, yes. Hopefully,
You might have another former in there. Might have another former in there.
Trump, you know, has openly talked of firing Sessions, though that seems to have chilled out on some of that. But Strange was backed by Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Majority Leader, U.S. Senate Majority Leader. Just fueled tons of money into Strange's reelection. Strange was viewed as, you know, being loyal to McConnell, though also he had done all he could to tie himself to Donald Trump as well. So, you know, you don't want to get too far out on this and act like Strange was some sort of moderate. He had, you know, as I said, had done everything he could to tie himself to Donald Trump. But Roy Moore, again, we could call him one of these, you know, insurgent conservatives, very, very fiery in his rhetoric, had really turned the race into a referendum, not so much on Strange, who didn't have much of a record because he's only been in office since February, but really turned it into a referendum on the Republican leadership in the Senate. So that'd be McConnell and McConnell's, you know, leadership team, who, especially by a lot of conservative activists, are kind of widely derided right now for their inability to get a Obamacare repeal through the Senate. Going back to some of the debt ceiling fights during Obama's term, a lot of conservatives, again, derided McConnell and then House Speaker John Boehner for compromising and pushing through bills that would raise the debt ceiling, so on and so forth. This leads us to Mississippi. Chris McDaniel was a big supporter of Roy Moore, was over in Alabama during Tuesday's race, and has been very vocal that the victory of Moore, the more, you know, Tea Party style insurgent conservative over the establishment-backed candidate, moves him, McDaniel, closer toward challenging Roger Wicker, who is up for re-election in 2018. Now, the two races, you don't want to overdraw the comparisons there. You know, Wicker's been in office since late 2007. He's hardly a new incumbent in the way that Strange was. And you know, Strange also had the baggage of having been appointed by a governor who has since resigned over a sex scandal. And then Strange, who was the state's attorney general, had been investigating the governor. So it was strange. There was the strange. There was the perception by many that there was kind of a crooked deal to drop the investigation, and if he got appointed. I don't follow Alabama politics super closely. I don't know what the evidence there is that that happened, but there was the perception of it. So that drug Strange down in many's eyes. Wicker doesn't have that same baggage, but certainly McDaniel has in recent weeks and months. He's been talking about challenging Wicker for months now. Has honed an angle of attack against Wicker very similar to Moore's campaign pitch. McDaniel, every time he speaks about this, he ties Wicker to McConnell, Mitch McConnell.
And obviously, in this case, that's an easier tie to make because Wicker is a member of the Senate leadership team.
That's right, he is. So, so there is that. He's trying to tie Wicker as this kind of establishment crony that's gone to D.C. and forgotten his Mississippi roots and has gone all in with this, you know, compromised leadership team. Again, that's how McDaniel paints it. So, I mean, we'll see if he runs. Steve Bannon, President Donald Trump's former advisor, is pushing McDaniel to run in 18. McDaniel admits as much, and there has been national reporting to that effect as well, that Bannon wants to oust a number of people he regards as being moderate in 18. That would include Jeff Flake, Senator in Arizona, Dean Heller, Senator in Nevada, and Wicker in Mississippi. So Bannon has ties to some deep-pocketed donors, so the money would be there if McDaniel gets into the race at this point. It's just whether he wants to do that. He's talked, if he doesn't run in 18, that he could run for lieutenant governor in the state in 2019.
So what does Wicker say about all this? Or has he said anything?
Well, you know, we haven't heard much directly on the campaign trail yet from Wicker. Certainly, he's putting together the campaign. I spoke to his campaign manager yesterday who, you know, for, I guess, somewhat obvious reasons, was reticent to say too much at this juncture. Campaigns are usually hesitant to speak about potential challengers until that person actually becomes a challenger. You don't want to pump up that person by making them appear as if you're already afraid of them. But his campaign manager just pointed out to me that, you know, Wicker is determined to be in the state as much as possible when he's not in D.C. on Senate business between now and the campaign, and that they're not too worried about the prospect of out-of-state money flowing in to a primary challenger. The quote I had in today's article from his campaign manager was, "We intend to be funded by Mississippi." Mm-hmm. So we'll see. Certainly Wicker is going to get, you know, PAC and super PAC donations from out of state. It's not as if he's only going to be funded by Mississippi, but we'll see what happens there. I will say Wicker has been doing his own part to pretty aggressively tie himself to Trump in recent weeks, came out very strongly supportive of Trump's statements at his first appearance at the United Nations, came out in favor of a tax reform framework that was recently released. So I think we're going to see this interesting dynamic, especially because, you know, in Alabama, Trump had endorsed Luther Strange, the more establishment candidate. So Strange, you know, really couldn't get through any appearance ever without just hammering that he was Donald Trump's endorsed candidate. But it would appear that Moore got more of the votes from the same sorts of people that like Trump. So I think we're going to see an interesting dynamic with incumbents trying to connect themselves to Trump, but then kind of primary challengers trying to connect themselves to Trump's agenda. So it's going to be interesting. Kind of, I think the 2018 primary races are going to be a battle over who is the legitimate representative of the Trump agenda.
It's really interesting that you said it is, there's like a disconnect, that disconnect between like Trump himself and then all of the other things, like his whole agenda.
Right, right.
You know, that's an interesting disconnect to think that.
McDaniel talked about that, actually. He was on Brian Fisher's AFR, American Family Radio program, yesterday. And that came up briefly, which is, you know, in McDaniel's views, the people that voted for Trump did so because they liked the fact that he was disruptive to the system, that he was going to shake up, you know, what's perceived as being a corrupt crony establishment in D.C., and that those same voters aren't necessarily then just going to line up behind whoever Trump tells them to vote for.
They're going to
vote
issues.
For the same sorts of candidates that they view as being disruptive, and certainly Roy Moore is expected to be disruptive and not play ball with McConnell. If he still has to beat a Democrat in December, but if he ends up in the Senate, he's probably not going to be a cooperative vote that McConnell can count on for anything. And McDaniel certainly promises that he would be the same sort of candidate and senator if he were elected.
All right. Well, thanks, Caleb. We'll, I'm sure we'll watch and see all this unfold, and it'll be very interesting.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Thank you.
All right, bye.
Don't forget to wake up every day and get ready with the Daily Journal's News Break, a quick summary of news, sports, weather, and everything else Northeast Mississippi in a 5-minute video. Shows are posted every Monday through Friday at 7 a.m., and you can watch them for free at any time at djournal.com, on Facebook, YouTube, or the Daily Journal's mobile apps for Apple and Android devices. It's a good way to stay informed on the latest happenings in your community in an easily digestible format.
And look for the two sports podcasts we produce here at the Daily Journal. Prep Rally is a high school sports podcast with Brad Locke and Dalton Middleton. New episodes air every Wednesday. You can listen to it free in iTunes, podcast apps, or at preprally.djournal.com. Ole Miss and Mississippi State sports fans, check out the Double Coverage podcast. Ole Miss beat reporter Parrish Alford and Mississippi State reporter Logan Lowry release a new episode each Thursday afternoon in which they provide game previews, insight, commentary, and analysis on the Bulldogs and Rebels. Listen free in iTunes, podcast apps, or at doublecoverage.djournal.com. And listen to the Daily Journal's newest podcast, Open, The Case of Lee Oche. Emma over here hosts and narrates it and takes a deep, fresh look at the Lee Oche disappearance from 25 years ago. It's an investigative reporting serial podcast over 6 episodes. You can find that in iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, wherever else you get your podcasts. And the website for that is djournal.com/openpodcast. We're now joined by food editor Jenna Parsons. Jenna, welcome back to the Memo. It's been a while.
It has. Thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you. I know you've got an interview in a minute, and I appreciate you making time for us. We'll get you out of here quick, but I just want to talk, obviously, about this week's food section and tell us, first of all, Chili Fest is coming up, and it's an event. I love chili, so I always look forward to it.
Well, it's Friday the 13th, October the 13th, and it's in downtown Tupelo on Broadway, as it always is. They will have lunch from, I think they're going to start a little early, 10:30 to 1 this year, pay $5, get a bowl of chili, barbecue by Jim, prepares that and all the fixings, and there'll be music. And then you can come back that night starting at 5, and that's $10. It'll be music, and you get a bowl of chili again, but you also get an opportunity to go and taste the different chilies from the different teams that'll be competing.
Right,
and
that's the big part. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. They right now, they don't have that many teams registered. I think maybe 10, but it's early. In fact, I know the Journal's going to have a team, and we haven't registered yet. So they're expecting maybe close 30, 35, 40 teams.
Good. Yeah, I think they've got capacity for 40, is what your story
said.
So if they get 30, 35, then that's right where they want to be. One thing your story talked about, they switched last year to a street-style kind of layout. I didn't make it then.
Well, I can't, you know.
Hard to describe.
Sometimes they run together. I don't remember.
Yeah,
did I go
sure.
last year or was that the year before? But in the past, they have had tents that were set up on the sidewalks.
Yeah, that's how I remember it.
And so if you were in a tent, you couldn't really see what was going on. Mm-hmm. And this time they moved the tents around the inside perimeter, I believe, so that it's more of a street festival feeling to it. You can walk around more easily.
Sure,
And they had a really good crowd last year. And so, you know, but as Craig Helmuth from Main Street said, this is a weather-dependent festival because they have it rain or shine.
Yeah, right.
And there's some years that we've had it, and it has been so hot that the last thing you want to do is eat chili. And some years it's been so cold that the wind made your eyes water.
Yeah.
So
October, you never know.
You get what you get.
It's often the perfect weather month, but then you never know.
Right.
Tell us, your column this week is about a bread, a pumpkin cranberry bread that you made.
It is. It actually, one of our copy editors, or page designers, I think we call them now, Pamela McCray, her husband Kirby, is the baker in the family, I believe.
Yeah.
And he made a couple of loaves of it, and I don't know where one loaf went, but one loaf came to us, and it was sitting over by the copy desk. And I wandered over there after lunch to look at pages or something, and it was sitting there, and there was maybe one piece gone. And I'm not a loaf bread kind of eater, but I saw it, and it was so pretty because the pumpkin had made it sort of a golden color, and then the cranberries, you know, you've got those little dots of red. And so I cut a piece and cut it in half, and I ate half and gave half to my husband.
Mm-hmm.
And we both took a couple of bites, and then I went and told everybody in the newsroom, y'all, I've got to go get a piece of that bread. It was so good. So Kirby shared the recipe with us. It is not, it's homemade. I mean, you use real ingredients, not starting with the cake mix. But the recipe is fairly simple.
And you mentioned the streusel
was kind of the
key.
Yes, it's got sugar and butter and cinnamon and nuts and a little bit of flour, and you sprinkle that on the top, and it just takes it over the top just a little bit.
Sure. Well, you can see that recipe at djournal.com or in Wednesday's paper. And I know you've got to run, but just real quick, your cook of the week, and again, people can read about her in the same places, but anything particular that stood out to you about this week's cook?
This is Susan Krell from Holly Springs, and she greeted us when we got there, the photographer and I, and she was wearing an apron that was her mother's. And almost every recipe that she gave me, I believe, were her mother's recipes. And the thing is that her mom was one of the best cooks that Susan knew. And she died just earlier this year. And she was in her 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And she had had Alzheimer's for 15 years. And so for those 15 years that her mom struggled with Alzheimer's, Susan could not pull out her mother's recipes and use them. It was too hard because her mother was fading and didn't remember people and didn't remember things. And Susan just couldn't use those recipes. But after her mom passed earlier this year, and she lost her dad earlier this year too, she has pulled out all her mother's recipes and making them all again and reliving those good memories now. And so she made for us a chocolate pie That was her mother's
specialty.
That was her mother's specialty, and it's what Susan now makes and takes to church and potlucks and things.
Sure, I'm curious about her jambalaya recipe too. That caught my attention. So.
I figure it would. It's different than anything I've seen. You just combine everything and you cook it for an hour. I mean,
wow.
I've never seen anything like that before, so I'll be interested to see that. Yeah. She also gave a recipe for I will say the jambalaya was not her mother's recipe. She got that when she lived in New Orleans. But a marinade for shrimp that it's kind of a white sauce, and you marinate the shrimp overnight. And I think that may have been one of her mom's recipes. And then she gave us several others that look worthy of trying.
Yeah, sounds great. Well, thanks, Jenna. Thanks for coming on and joining us today.
Thank you, Chris.
All right, we've now got Scott Morris. And Scott, welcome back to the Memo. It's been a while.
Oh, yeah, y'all blackballed me for a while, and after I washed your car, what, was three times or four times? I can't recall. I had help the fourth time. Well, I'd help the fourth time. The fifth time, they must have done it for me out of pity.
I don't know, but that's the rules to play.
Yeah, well.
Gotta pay to play. Anyway, back with another movie review. Glad to be back and have you back giving your movie reviews. This week's movie, Kingsman: The Golden Circle, and you were not a fan. Walk us through it and kind of what you saw as some of the flaws with the movie.
Well, so first off, though, early on, you know that the villain is a person named Poppy, played by Julianne Moore, and you know it's going to be a campy thing, and I kind of thought about it kind of like an old Batman episode, because she's living in this jungle city, this ancient deserted jungle city that she's like turned into like a 1950s Wonderland with a diner and a bowling alley and a hot dog stand and a theater, things like that. So let's just go with it. I said, all right, I'll go with it. I don't mind. But the problem is that this happens sometimes with action films. It happens with just films in general. It's just that I just found very difficult to care from one scene to the next after a while. Taron Egerton is back as Eggsy from the original Kingsman. And I like that movie. I gave it an A-.
Okay.
I mean, it was just about a kind of a secret agent deal. It was kind of cartoony. It had, who's the guy on all those Capital One commercials? Samuel L. Jackson. Had him as the villain in it, and Colin Firth was in it. And I remember enjoying that. But here, it's just like things happen, and you'd have a couple of moments where, that's interesting. But then, I don't know, I would just kind of, whatever momentum they started to build, they would end it somehow. Elton John is in it.
Yeah, a lot of big names.
Yeah, a lot of big names. And Elton, you know, it's one of those situations to where it could be funny and it could not be funny. And, you know, moments were kind of amusing, but other things were just kind of clearly just camped up to the extreme that just weren't funny. So, if you're supposed to laugh, I was thinking, what grade am I going to give it? And I realized that I was sitting in the theater, which is not what you want to do when you're watching the movie. You want to be caught up in the movie. And I just realized, and I was thinking, how many times was I sitting in the theater, realizing I was in the theater? And it was enough to where, as I was writing my review, because I was thinking, was it that bad? I mean, I kind of wanted to see how it ended anyway, but I think that's just storytelling structure in general. It kind of hooks you on some level. But I just got down to the point where after I wrote my review, I said, I would like to give this a D and have some redeeming factors, but no, not even a D-. I thought about D- for a while. And I just had, just be honest, Scott. Just be honest with yourself.
Sometimes it's
not
best.
Even the people. I don't care about the people. Be honest with yourself, Scott. You saw an F movie, and you have to admit that. I mean, you don't owe Taron Egerton anything or Elton John anything. Just give it the F it deserves.
Is part of the problem, you mentioned it not making you just care about where it goes. I mean, in reading the review, I kind of got lost in all the plot points.
That would be my fault, I guess.
Well, yeah, maybe I'll give the writing an F too, but no. Scott knows I'm playing with him.
Well, now I do.
Just reading it, honestly, I took it more as just the movie was kind of, it felt like maybe it was all over the place because, Eggsy, it talks about he's with, Tildy, and then he's doing something with Merlin, and then he's doing something with whiskey, and I'm just like, who are these characters? And I mean, okay, is that part of it? It all kind of makes sense
if you're watching it. And I apologize for the way I wrote it. Thank you very much. I'll go back to remedial movie review school, I guess. It all makes sense what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's just not funny. And it's just like, you have these scenes that just are very flat, and mm-hmm. I don't know how to fix it. If I knew how to fix it, I would be making a lot more money somewhere else. I was very proud of myself at the opening because they were playing, I'm pretty sure it was the bagpipes. And I recognized the tune. It was Country Roads by John mm-hmm. Denver. And I thought, that's got to be Country Roads. I'm listening. And then they kind of went orchestral right after I got it. And I thought, well, maybe I was wrong. Well, later on, Merlin starts singing it. And well, they're not going to West Virginia. They're going to Kentucky.
Right.
And it's just that those type of decisions being made, a little detail. And it's like, well, they're going to Kentucky, and there's got to be a Kentucky. There's like a Kentucky Rain song. There's Kentucky songs.
Right.
I mean, Country Road is a West Virginia song. And yet it's like there all throughout in some kind of weird thing that repeats. And it's supposed to be at this very emotional moment toward the end of the movie when a character is in a tight spot. And it's like, yeah, but it still should be Kentucky. Why are you singing this song? So just little details like that just doesn't make any sense. You know, the original Kingsman mm-hmm. was wacky. I mean, it's just at the end, it's like a Bond movie just amped up. And I'm figuring that kind of farce, that kind of exaggerated storytelling, is difficult to pull off. I mean, I loved the Batman show when I was mm-hmm. a kid, but the whole time I loved it, I was like, why do I love this? Even as a kid, because it was so goofy. But something about it worked. And so I think that maybe pulling off a story like this is a lot harder than anyone might suppose. Still, it's an F.
So one of those movies, sometimes I feel like they do this where they just stack up the cast with a lot of really big names. And then the movie itself is kind of just like, I don't know what I just watched, but all these really famous people are, you know what I mean? You go cause you like all these actors and then you're kind of like, I don't know what's going on.
Well, I think that like Jeff Bridges is in it and mm-hmm. he's got a part, and the part could be played by anybody, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you could have just chosen like any kind of character actor and you could have played that part. Jeff Bridges didn't bring anything specifically Jeff Bridges to the role mm-hmm. and he didn't really have time to. I mean, he could have, I guess maybe like Daniel Craig could have been wonderful for those 5 minutes, but you know, Jeff Bridges just pulled off kind of an exaggerated Southern accent for a while and played somebody in charge. And so there was nothing like, he wasn't asked to do anything dramatic. I mean, he was mainly...
Like, he didn't need Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, he was basically there for exposition, mm-hmm. basically. Yeah. He needed Julianne Moore, and I thought at first, you know, having a female villain, that's cool. You know, let's mm-hmm. see all what happens. But then, it lost me early on and kept me lost for much of the movie.
Well,
but it all makes sense. It's just not entertaining.
Sure.
Hmm.
Flat.
Yeah, like my writing, apparently.
Well, I don't know if anyone still wants to see it.
Yeah, it's at the Malco and the Cinemark.
Yeah, Malco, Cinemark.
Somebody out there is going to be like, I'm going to go decide
for
myself.
There were at least like 15 people in the theater with us when we saw it.
There you go.
Huh.
My dad sees movies with me, and when he's not entertained, he sighs loudly.
Was there a lot of sighing going on?
There's a lot of sighing going on.
There you go. There's your review. Scott's dad sighed during the movie. That's all you need to know. Thanks, Scott.
Says it all.
You betcha.
Keep up with Mississippi politics by watching the Daily Journal's Capitol View webcast each Monday afternoon at djournal.com. Capitol Bureau Chief Bobby Harrison provides commentary and analysis on the issues being debated in Jackson. Watch live on Monday afternoons at 2 p.m. or catch a replay later in the day.
And then, of course, we're supposed to have Derek on now. Normally, we'd have Derek on now to talk about his scene section. He, unfortunately, is out sick again today. So we'll just kind of give you the highlights real quick from the weekend entertainment scene. You can see it again Thursday's paper or at djournal.com. The Garden Brothers Circus will be at the Bancorp South Arena today at 4:30 and again at 7:30. Tickets are $24 for adults, $34 for VIP. Children are $8 and $18 for VIP. Garden Brothers Circus, I'm not familiar with them. I guess that's the replacement for Barnum and Bailey. Huh?
Yeah, I don't know. I've never heard of the Garden Brothers. I wonder if it involves vegetables or plants, maybe.
Where the name comes from, maybe they throw plants, juggle.
They throw beets.
Yeah, juggle tomatoes
through hoops. That sounds cool.
Yeah,
check potential. It out.
Maybe they feed the elephants cucumbers.
I don't know. Find they could carrots. I don't know.
Yeah, find that tonight. And the Traverse Brothership will perform at Blue Canoe on Saturday at 8:30. And Derek's got a feature story about a new play, Greater Tuna. The interesting thing about that play is it's two actors who play something like 20 roles. Each one has, it's Carlton Wall and Jamie Farr, and each have about 10 characters. It's based on a small town in Texas, the third, called Tuna, Texas, which is the third smallest town in the state. And apparently it's a series of plays. So if this one goes well, there's three other plays about tuna that they can perform. That is at 7 o'clock tonight and 7 o'clock Saturday night and 2 o'clock on Sunday. You can catch that at the Claude Gentry Theater in downtown Baldwin. And there is also the Haunted House. He's got a story about the Haunted Castle coming in East Tupelo. So you can check that out. I guess it's that time of year already. Halloween coming up before you know it. And so read about the Haunted Castle and check it out. It opens this weekend. Another good show?
Yeah, good show. I enjoyed talking to Caleb about that Senate race. It's just some really interesting stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be, I guess we're in for an interesting 2018.
Yeah, I mean, what was it, 2014, I guess, was when they was the wicker on McDaniel, and that was just huge. I mean, that was, obviously, there was a story that summer, and it was just so vitriol. We were talking about it off air, I guess, but just about how nasty that campaign got and everything with the nursing home and the guy committing suicide who got charged in that. And I think Caleb was saying there was a Jeff Pender, the Clarion Ledger had a column about, hey, if we're going through this all again, let's at least make some ground rules to
let's calm down a little
to not go to that level. But yeah,
hopefully be as wild.
It's so intense, but I'm sure if it happens, it'll be another intense race.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
well, alrighty.
We'll see.
Cool. Well, thanks for listening and have a good weekend.
Yeah. You can catch the Memo in iTunes, Google Play, podcast apps. Visit our website, memo.djournal.com. Follow us on Twitter at djournalmemo. You can read all the stories we talked about today at djournal.com and follow Daily Journal on Twitter at djournalnow. Thanks for joining us. You can hear, you know, this is our entertainment episode. Normally, if we had some news conversation, our normal news episode comes out on Wednesday.
I would argue to say that politics kind of falls under entertainment sometimes. So I don't.
That's you're fair.
Kind of straddles and the line.
That could turn into a pretty entertaining entertaining election if it happens. So yeah, well, fair. Well, it fits then. but our previous episode this week was going was a really interesting discussion, going a lot more in depth about the Open Podcast with Emma and William Moore, Daily Journal's law enforcement reporter, just talking about their reporting on that case, moderated by Daily Journal editor Rod Guajardo. So I encourage you to check that out as well. And we'll be back next week.